Tax update for Saturday, January 20th, 2007. This is tax update for Saturday, January 20th, 2007. This week, literally too good to be true, an IRS memorandum on a partnership transaction. The tax update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. Podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can find them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, we're going to take a look at a recent IRS legal memorandum on a partnership transaction where the IRS basically targeted an attempt by a taxpayer to use the literal interpretation of Section 731 and 732 to avoid tax on using his soon-to-be-redeemed partnership interest to obtain a house that he wished to obtain, and to do so at no tax cost. The memorandum, ILM 2006-50014, gives an insight to what methods the IRS might employ to recast transactions that attempt to use the partnership rules in ways the IRS decides maybe goes beyond what the service believes the rules were intended to be used for. Partnerships are incredibly flexible entities, and their flexibility is what's made them such an interesting place for people looking for tax shelters to market, and people looking for unusual transactions to deal with have found it a very attractive place to go because of that flexibility. The catch becomes that the IRS now has weapons in their arsenal, specifically the anti-abuse regulations that are meant to allow them to target such transactions. This week, what we're going to look at is one of the issues where a taxpayer attempted to literally follow the letter of the law as found in sections 731 and 732 for a partnership. And even though the IRS essentially agrees that this may be literally correct, especially if we allow one fact, they have three different analyses they use to attack this, and only the first one would say the law still applies as it is, and even that one has a little issue about a definition of what is partnership property. But the IRS would agree if this is partnership property, it literally complied, but their theory is it does not comply with the spirit and with the regulations that they have available at 1.701-2, which is the anti-abuse regulations for partnerships. They're able to deal with this and a claim that they can recast the transaction. And in fact, that's one of the deals that they try to do in this week's analysis. Well, to understand this analysis, we first have to understand what are the basic rules. So we're going to do a quick review of the basic rules we deal with partnerships. Now, partnerships have a huge advantage of being an incredibly flexible entity to work with. They have much more liberal rules for transferring property in and out of them without triggering a negative tax event. For instance, on formation, Section 721 that applies to transfers into a partnership does not have the control requirement that we find in Section 351 for tax-free contributions to a corporation, and it's even possible to contribute property that has debt in excess of your basis and still not trigger a gain in a partnership if you are deemed to acquire other debt or take over other debt that other partners may have contributed or which the partnership has already in place. Therefore, it's a far more flexible routine to get in. As well, getting out is also a relatively flexible transaction. Now, getting assets out of a corporation is always a major problem. In a corporation, a distribution of assets out of the corporation is problematical. If the asset's appreciated, Section 311B requires the corporation recognize the gain. Secondly, after that recognition is done, then we measure what the partner, basically the shareholder receives if it is a dividend or considered to be a taxable dividend under the rules for a dividend. Basically, we have a C corporation or we have an S corporation with accumulated E&P that we've exhausted AAA on. Then we measure that by the fair market value of what comes out of the corporation. If we have an S corporation, Section 311B still applies if it's appreciated, so we still pay tax on the appreciation trying to take it out of the S corporation, and then we compare the fair market value of what we have received versus our basis in the S corporation at that point to again compute whether we have a gain or loss, and whether we have to recognize a capital gain now or some other type of income recognition when we pull that funds out of the S corporation. The default rule for a partnership is a lot more liberal. Now, while there are a number of special case rules that are meant to keep us from contributing appreciated property under 721 and then pulling out other property to essentially effect an exchange that would not be allowed under Section 1031, the general rules allow for a lot of flexibility, and if we clear these special rules, we can basically take property that's not cash out of the partnership and not trigger a tax event to the partner or the partnership with that transaction. That's the general rule that we find. Section 731 governs the distributions from a partnership. And Section 731A provides generally at A1 that gain shall not be recognized to a partner except to the extent any money distributed exceeds the adjusted basis of the partner's interest in the partnership immediately before the distribution. Now, let's not forget one complicating factor in that is that the deemed relief from debt, basically the reduction in debt that the partner is presumed to have been relieved from in certain transactions, is considered a distribution of money from the partnership and can trigger a gain transaction. But if we don't have cash or that debt relief theory coming out at us, we can receive property generally tax-free if we don't trigger any of the other special rules that require us to recognize gain. Those special rules generally get triggered only when we have contributed appreciated property to the partnership. So essentially, I can contribute property. Let's say I could go into the partnership today. We could buy a building. I could distribute and take that building out of the partnership 10 years down the line. And even though it's greatly appreciated and I have an asset worth far more than what I initially put into the partnership, I still don't trigger a gain on distribution. Now, the offset of that is that a loss also is generally not recognized by the partner in such a distribution. There is a limited exception to that that was found in 731A2 that we won't go into at this point. But basically, normally, a distribution from the partnership is neither a gain nor a loss transaction. And if it's not a liquidation distribution, therefore, it's never a loss transaction, and it may only be in the gain transaction, only looks at cash received. Now, this is a lot more liberal than a C corporation or even an S corporation shareholder gets in their distribution. Note the partnership also. There's no equivalent to Section 311B for the partnership. Section 731B holds that no gain or loss shall be recognized to a partnership on distribution to a partner of property, including money. Therefore, at the partnership level, that appreciated building left the partnership. The partnership's not required to recognize gain on that transaction either. It's a non-event at the partnership level. Well, this is a great structure and a great deal for being able to move assets freely in and out. It also suggests that I can be redeemed of my partnership interest, not trigger a gain, as long as I can convince the partnership to give me something other than money in exchange for my interest. What's the trade-off on this? Well, the trade-off is that our basis is limited in any property that we receive to the property left over after the monetary distribution. So if I receive property out in basis, my basis generally is the lesser of, if it's not a liquidating distribution, the basis of the property in the partnership's hands or my remaining basis in my partnership interest. And that is governed by Section 732, where basically we have these slightly different distributions depending upon whether we have a regular distribution or a liquidating distribution. And essentially, we will get our gain or loss. If you have no remaining basis, let's say we've gotten cashed out for our entire basis, we have zero basis remaining in our partnership interest, we receive property, not cash from the partnership, no reduction in debt. If that happens, we just get property with a zero basis. Well, I guess that's bad news in one sense, because now I may have a building worth millions of dollars with no basis, but that's not really bad news until I finally sell the building and convert it to cash. Most of our clients have given the choice between paying tax today and having a higher basis, or delaying the payment of tax and somewhere down the line paying on a larger gain, are clearly going to elect I'll take the lower basis. Basis isn't worth a whole lot, especially when I have to pay tax today to get it. Therefore, for a partnership, this is a wonderful device. For a corporation, obviously, they're much more restricted in getting assets back out. That's the reason why, as we're all fairly well aware, generally we don't like to see appreciating assets in a corporation for the very reason that we have a tough time getting them out without triggering the double tax situation in the corporation. And that's true even in an S corporation where we may be able to avoid the double tax. There's still that triggering single tax that an LLC, that basically a partnership or an LLC operating as a partnership, allows us to avoid generally. Well, now let's consider the facts in the transaction that the IRS was upset about. This is the facts in question. The taxpayer in question was a partner in a partnership where apparently the partners were bickering among each other, and there was a decision made essentially to redeem out most of the partners and leave a much smaller group in there. And our taxpayer in this transaction is one of those who is leaving the partnership. And so what was agreed upon for this partner is a couple of steps would be taken because this partner is looking at getting rid of his interest. He also has a property, a house he wants to acquire independently. He wants to basically acquire this house. And he's looking and saying, well, I'm going to be cashed out of my partnership interest. That's going to give me access to the wealth. And I could use that wealth perhaps to help me acquire the house. And maybe I can structure it in such a way that I could avoid some tax on liquidation of my partnership interest by simply reducing the basis in that house. So here's the transaction that was basically agreed upon. The partner would be paid a certain amount in cash as partial payment for his interest. And in fact, the payment, when combined with the deemed distribution due to debt relief under Section 752B, was greater than the remaining interest in his partner, the remaining basis in his partnership interest. Therefore, this taxpayer received money in excess of his partnership interest, paid some gain there. However, there was still more fair value of the interest than the cash was agreeing to take. Well, how is he going to get the rest of the buyout? That's where things got a little cuter. In this case, the remaining amount of his interest would be paid for by receiving an asset from the partnership. The big caveat was the partnership didn't own this asset as of the date we entered into this agreement for the redemption. Instead, the taxpayer identified a house that he wanted the partnership to acquire and distribute to him. The partnership would acquire that house that the partner had chosen. It put it in a single-member LLC that the partnership would form for the purpose of acquiring this house. To the extent the partnership expended more for the house, which it would, in this case, was going to, than the amount of the remaining buyout of this partner, the partner would agree to basically finance the property, get a mortgage on the property, and then repay the partnership for that excess amount that would be distributed to him, the excess value. The agreement provided for what would happen if he didn't close on the loan in a timely fashion. And essentially it provided if he didn't close, we would sell off the property, we would go ahead and pay off any amounts the partnership had borrowed to purchase this property, and then any remaining balance that would be paid out to the partner who had failed to get the loan to qualify. So essentially, there'd be a short-term sale. And he would now be cashed out if he could not close on this loan. Now, this was all signed. It was signed in an agreement to redeem his interest. It's written down in paper. The IRS cites it in their memorandum. Now, the partnership formed the LLC in question and acquired the house in year one. The LLC obtained the loan for the excess amount for purchasing the house from another partner of the partnership who was also being redeemed out. Now, that meant essentially that what became the bridge loan was being provided by another interested party in the transaction. In year two, the taxpayer took out a mortgage on the house. He repaid the LLC, who then repaid the other partner. Now, this transaction, I suspect, was probably because a third-party lender wanted the partner to sign on the document immediately, wanted him to be liable. No third-party lender was going to step in and allow their and issue the loan to the partnership and then allow that to be assigned. So that's why we had this third party who was involved that temporarily put up the money that then was repaid. Because I suspect that those advising the partner said it would probably be really, really bad looking if, in fact, you were liable on the loan from day one. It looks like you bought the house. So what we're going to do is we're going to have your buddy here, Partner B, loan the money to the partnership. And then that way he'll be the one carrying it temporarily until such time as you then sign off and get the other loan and are able to pay back the partnership in the second year. And we hopefully have enough spread in time here to see that we had the first transaction happen in year one, the second in year two. Doesn't that look good? It looks like, you know, we split it over 2 years. So maybe there's less chance it'll be looked at. That doesn't appear to have worked in this case since obviously the transaction has now been looked at. Now, in the taxpayer's view, what happened? Well, the taxpayer first offset and got rid of his entire basis with the cash and the deemed relief of debt under 752B. So basically, he recognized some gain on that transaction. Then, for the house, though, he recognized no gain on receipt of the equity in the house from the partnership. Rather, he treated that as a distribution of property governed by Section 731. And as he notes, the house is not money. Therefore, no gain or loss to be recognized. Therefore, he take the house. The only difference is his only basis in the house is going to be for the debt he borrowed to pay back the partnership for the excess value. Otherwise, he basically, you know, he takes a reduction in basis. And so down the line, if he ever sells the house, which the ruling doesn't state, but it would appear may very well have been a personal residence that could then eventually be subject to Section 121 exclusion, he would exclude that gain. But it was a nice little structure there. Now, in the taxpayer's view, he'd managed to convert his partnership interest from an interest in the from basically into an interest in the house he wanted in a tax-free transaction. And based on the literal interpretation of the code, it appears it should work. Now, because you note, there are provisions in the code that are meant to prevent tax-free exchanges of a sort that could not meet the 1031 test otherwise. But most of these are geared toward the theory where a taxpayer puts appreciated property into a partnership and then within a short time pulls out other property to replace that appreciated property. So it's kind of the partnership was merely kind of a step between to execute an exchange that otherwise wouldn't work under 1031. And we have codified provisions to stop that transaction. But in this case, the property going into the partnership was not appreciated. Coming out of the partnership was not appreciated. That house was worth about the same the partnership acquired it for. The appreciated piece of property in this transaction was the partnership interest itself. And that is not considered generally a tainted interest that would trigger the gain. So, according to this taxpayer and his advisors, everything should be well and this should be a non-tax transaction. Well, the IRS objected to this. And in the memorandum, raised three theories about why they think it doesn't work. The first theory goes back and looks at, which holds that essentially the house was never partnership property. That theory goes back to the old original committee reports on the adoption of the 1954 Internal Revenue Code and the initial adoptions of Sections 721 and 731. Now, they cite both the House Ways and Means Committee and the Finance Committee reports. And they point out the purpose of the provision was to allow taxpayers to move assets freely into and out of a partnership for a business purpose. In fact, the IRS puts a highlight on a line from the Senate Committee, Finance Committee report that says these rules combined with the non-recognition of gain or loss upon contribution of property to a partnership will remove deterrence to properties being moved in and out of partnerships as business reasons dictate. The IRS is concerned in this case there is no business reason for what's going on. The IRS notes under the facts presented in this case, a carryover basis is not appropriate for a unique parcel of residential property that apparently was selected by the distributee, acquired by the partnership immediately before distribution solely for the purpose of the distribution, and was unrelated to their business activities. The IRS goes on to note that the partnership never really was the owner of the property. As the IRS points out, if the deal fell through, all the risk and rewards of that time period, if the value of the house had dropped, the partner being redeemed is the one who took the hit for that. If the value of the property had gone up, but he couldn't close on the loan, he would get the gain from it. the partnership basically had nothing to do, had no risk one way or the other in the transactions. The risk and rewards of ownership from day one were in the hands of the partner. The IRS also reasoned that the case is similar to the fact pattern in Revenue Ruling 5539, where the taxpayer directed a partnership to acquire securities with his capital account. In that ruling, the IRS basically ruled the segregation of funds and investment in selected securities that then were basically always out, any gains, losses, income were always allocated back to the partner, amounted to a distribution to the taxpayer of the funds used to purchase the investment followed by the purchase. In this case, therefore, the IRS argues, like in Revenue Ruling 5539, the proper interpretation is to treat this as a distribution of cash to the shareholder, to the partner, followed by the acquisition by the partner of the house, and that distribution of cash, therefore, would be taxable under Section 731, because that would be a distribution of money in excess of his basis. And therefore, the IRS essentially holds that the partnership merely was distributing or paying out the cash on behalf of the partner, therefore it's treated as if distributed to the partner. Now, the only hitch is that first theory. This is why the IRS now goes on to two more alternative theories. That first theory works only if you buy the line that this was never partnership property. Well, the IRS attorney who's presenting the memorandum goes on to state, even if you accept that that was partnership property, he believes there are two other ways that this transaction needs to be disregarded. The first one is the regulation, and I believe I misspoke earlier, and said 701-2, it's 702-2. In Regulation 702-2, the IRS has the anti-abuse rules for partnerships. And the first alternative theory, basically, that it's caught by those anti-abuse rules. And the regulation holds that if the activity violates those rules, the IRS can recast a transaction under Reg 1.702-2B to be viewed in a more appropriate form. Regulation 1.702-2A provides an intent test that tests transactions the partnerships need to overcome in order to be respected. So a transaction to be respected has to meet this intent test. And A tells us that the intent of subchapter K is to permit taxpayers to conduct joint business, including investment activities, through a flexible economic arrangement without incurring an entity-level tax. Then it goes on to hold implicit in the intent of subchapter K are the following requirements, and it lists three. That one, the partnership must be bona fide in each partnership transaction or series of related transactions, individually or collectively, must be entered into for a substantial business purpose, and the form of each partnership transactions must be respected under substance over form principles. And three, that basically the transactions have to have a proper reflection of income between the partners and the partnership based upon the true economic agreement. Now, based upon that, if the regulation violates Regulation 1.702-2A, 1.702-2B holds in part that accordingly, if a partnership is formed or availed of in connection with a transaction, a principal purpose of which is to reduce substantially the present value of the partner's aggregate federal tax liability in a manner that's inconsistent with the intent of subchapter K, the commissioner can recash the transaction for federal tax purposes as appropriate to receive the tax or results that are consistent with the intent of subchapter K in light of the applicable statutory and regulatory provisions and the pertinent facts and situations. So if you have a transaction that violates the intent of subchapter K, the IRS now under the regulation claims the right to recast it to something more appropriate. So the memorandum looks at this transaction and, not surprisingly, includes a trap by Regulation 1.702-2, noting, to liquidate taxpayer's interest in the partnership made a purported distribution to the taxpayer the fair market value of the state Y house, in addition to the debt release total cash payment to the taxpayer for the value of the interest in the partnership. Because it's exceeded the base in the partnership, the partnership would have had to recognize an additional amount of income, basically the amount, the value of that house, less what he paid back, if it had been paid directly to the taxpayer, essentially instead of paying it to buy the house. By attempting to characterize the distribution of the fair market value of state Y house as a distribution of property other than money, taxpayer in partnership used the rules of subchapter K inappropriately in a manner that attempted to eliminate that X dollars of gain with respect to the taxpayer. The memorandum goes on to state, we conclude the transaction should be recast and according to the anti-abuse rules of 1.701-2 as a distribution to A in cash to the taxpayer, which taxpayer then used in addition to funds provided directly, albeit temporarily, by B to acquire the statewide house. And I seem to be confusing my reg sections again. It's 701-2. So take that correctly. It is 01, not 02. I've got them rated in here two ways in my notes. Nevertheless, under that regulation, the IRS takes the position that they can recast a transaction if it fails an intent test, and the theory is this fails an intent test. Well, the IRS goes to step three just in case the court decides maybe it didn't fail the intent test, and it falls back on the old good things that to the IRS that they like to use, the judicially created doctrines of step transaction and economic substance. Now, this is the last one they bring up because I suspect it is the most difficult one for the service to win over, all the ones courts are least likely to feel comfortable going with. But ultimately, it's the fallback position if it just doesn't smell right, and to the IRS, this transaction clearly doesn't smell right. In this case, the memorandum cites a description of the step transaction doctrine from the case of Smith versus Commissioner, 78 TC 350 and 389, 1982. Which was affirmed on appeal to the Fourth Circuit. And this particular case, the tax court held, the step transaction doctrine generally applies in a case where a taxpayer seeks to get from point A to point D and does so stopping in between at points B and C. The whole purpose of the unnecessary stops is to achieve tax consequences differing from those which a direct path from A to D would have produced. In such a situation, courts are not bound by the twisted path taken by the taxpayer, and the intervening stops may be disregarded or rearranged. Now, the memorandum outlines three tests for the application of the step transaction doctrine. Per the memorandum, there are three alternative tests for deciding whether the step transaction doctrine applies in a particular situation. Namely, one, if at the time of the first step was entered into, there was a binding commitment to undertake the later steps, the binding commitment test. Second, if the separate steps constitute a prearranged part of a single transaction intended to reach an end result, the end result test. Or three, if the separate steps are so interdependent that the legal relations created by one step would have been fruitless without a completion of the series of steps. That is the interdependence test. The memorandum then goes on to argue that this transaction clearly meets both the first and second tests and is going to fail for that purpose and be eligible for step transaction reclassification. There was a binding commitment in the redemption agreement from the start to complete every step of the transaction in order. And the transactions were a prearranged series of steps that clearly were arranged primarily to take a partnership interest and give and allow the partner to obtain the house that the partner wanted to obtain with the wealth he was going to get from liquidating his partnership interest. Now, on top of that, the IRS sends a second theory in here and throws economic substance at the transaction, arguing there was no economic substance to the partnership's involvement in this transaction whatsoever. The memorandum goes on to say, objectively, partnership's purchase of statewide house and immediate distribution to taxpayer had no practical economic effects aside from the avoidance of gain recognition. The acquisition of the statewide house was structured to avoid any potential gain or loss by the partnership on the transaction. And we note that appears to be clearly true. If you take a look at the agreement, there was no way the partnership could have either a gain or loss on this transaction so long as the partner fulfilled his obligations. Taxpayer was apparently entitled to the value, basically the net equity value from the partnership, and we received that much value from the partnership. The use of the residential property acquired solely for the purpose of avoiding gain recognition on that value had no objective economic effect. Goes on to note, subjectively, partnership and taxpayer clearly had no intent to profit economically from the transaction, that is, acquisition and following distribution to the partner. It is evidence from the term of the redemption agreement that the statewide house would be distributed by LLC to the taxpayer immediately upon taxpayer obtaining a loan within 60 days to fund the purchase. In addition, the LLC would be reimbursed all costs and expenses associated with the purchase of the statewide house if the taxpayer could not obtain necessary loan within 60 days. The LLC could immediately sell the statewide house. It's difficult to conclude an intent to profit from the purchase sale of a house in a brief 60-day period. Clearly, the sole purpose of the transaction was to obtain tax benefits that would not be available otherwise. Therefore, the IRS concluded under any one of these three theories, the transaction fails and the taxpayer will pay tax on that additional gain. Now, it's important to note, this is a legal memorandum, not a court decision. We're not even close to that yet. There would be the issue if litigated whether the courts will go along with this. But this memorandum is out there primarily, I believe, and has been publicized by the IRS as kind of a warning shot to warn practitioners not to get too cute with the partnership rules. Due to their flexibility, partnership has been a favorite area for aggressive tax planning strategies. It led to the anti-abuse regulations found in regulation section 1.701-2 and quite a bit of litigation in the economic substance and estate transaction areas, as taxpayers have attempted to use literal compliance with the partnership rules to achieve objectives that otherwise would be difficult to obtain, that is, basis shifts or avoidance of gain recognition or other structures. The particular transaction is interesting because this one was not a marketed tax shelter that got the IRS upset. Nobody went and found people and said, we're going to form this partnership for purposes of making advantage of Subchapter K. Rather, we really, in this case, had a partnership that already existed for valid business purposes that we were just getting out of. But attempting to arrange a transaction to get out of this partnership was what drew the IRS's ire. The IRS at this point in time, because of the tax shelter work we saw done and all the work we saw in the partnership arena, does appear to be particularly sensitive to what they feel are abuses in Subchapter K. And it's important to remember, with the regulation at 1.701-2, the IRS does at least claim to have a very solid basis for moving things around. They claim the regulatory, presuming the regulation is valid and presuming the IRS has the type of discretion that it appears the regulation grants them, they would have a very significant tool to move things around. And the IRS, at least in exam, it appears, is certainly willing to threaten to use that tool. So we need to consider for our taxpayers who have partnerships both the flexibility of this arrangement, which is important to remember the incredible flexible nature of the partnership. If you have a valid economic reason for these things, the partnership does wonderfully. It is an incredibly flexible device, important to remember. But it's also important to note that you probably run the risk of the IRS wanting things reclassified if you attempt to take advantage of this by a structure, as in this case, of attempting to make use of this provision to accomplish something that otherwise would not be able to be accomplished, and it doesn't appear to have any relation to what the partnership was doing. In that case, be aware of this particular ruling or this memorandum and the IRS's theories on these cases. Now, we're working up now, as we say, getting into tax season. This is the fun part of the year. I'm going to be speaking, actually, on the day this podcast comes out, the Phoenix Tax Workshop on an Arizona tax update. So that could be an interesting set of things, and I may get an Arizona podcast out for those of you doing the Arizona version. I may try to see if I get some time to get that recorded this weekend to kind of go over what I did at the Phoenix Tax Workshop. We're also, as I say, coming into tax season. It makes for a fun period of time. We've seen a number of interesting cases come down. That means I should have a few things to talk about in the next few weeks, even if nothing else comes down. I suspect more will. And we are starting to see the first tax bills kind of start moving around in the Congress. So we may have some interesting things develop in the near future. At least we will keep an eye on some of the proposals and some of the issues that are bouncing around our new Congress. This has been the Tax Update for Saturday, January the 20th, 2007. As always, Tax Update is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Please visit them to get information related to tax-related matters of interest to the subscribers and consider subscribing to their services. This has been the Tax Update for Saturday, January the 20th.